Recently, last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp, and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so.
It's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths.
November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range conditions, vaccine hesitancy and skepticism. Is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They say they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. They call me when I had it. I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see? A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something. I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
in the limelight. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, hospitals in nearly half of U.S. states are nearing capacity, as the Omicron variant has triggered a record number of cases across the country. We now present you an article written by Eric Berger. The piece is titled, Is the U.S. Nearing its COVID Peak? Experts warn against letting guard down. In February 2021, Dr. Craig Spencer wrote in a Medium post that he was as eager as anyone to see the end of this pandemic. Thankfully, that may be in sight. Dr. Craig Spencer, Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, wrote, COVID centers and hospitalizations are dropping. Vaccines are getting into arms. So what happens next? Next was, of course, more COVID-19. So almost a year later, while Dr. Craig Spencer is encouraged by the fact that the growth in the number of new COVID cases has slowed down in parts of the country, he has been humbled by earlier waves and is not ready to celebrate the beginning of the end of the pandemic. Dr. Spencer said, "It's not like you get to the top of Everest, have a small party and then start your ascent down and take off your oxygen mask," adding, "There is still risk when you start your descent, and I think it's important for all of us to continue to be wary and aware of that." While the United States has over the last month broken records for COVID hospitalizations and cases due to the highly contagious Omicron variant, the Northeast has seen a decrease in the number of daily new COVID cases, or a slowing down of the rate of increase, prompting predictions that the worst of the pandemic will soon be over. But infectious disease experts say that's premature because of how unpredictable the virus has been and the fact that it is still surging and overwhelming hospitals in parts of the country. Dr. Celine Gunder, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at New York University, said, "Yes, particularly in places like New York City, Omicron is peaking, but I think we have to be very careful not to confuse peaking with a low." Dr. Celine Gunder added, "That means people who are going out and about, living their normal lives, need to be careful to still make use of mitigation measures like wearing higher quality face masks and doing as much outdoors as possible." According to data from the New York Times, in the Northeast, the number of daily new cases has started to decline in recent days. But other places continue to experience a spike in cases. For example, 10 states saw a more than 300% increase in cases over the last 2 weeks. Across the United States, there has been a 133% increase in cases and a 79% increase in COVID hospitalizations over that period. Justin Lessler, an epidemiology professor at the University of North Carolina, says, "I think it's very possible that we may be at a peak, and certainly that would be in line with a lot of modeling results in terms of timing, which projected peaks in mid to late January. But at the same, until we see a few more days of consistent downward trends and start to see that reflected in hospitalizations as well, I would be cautious." Despite the slowing down of the surge, when Dr. Spencer worked a shift recently in the emergency room at Columbia in New York, he said, "It was just as chaotic for me as it was for my colleagues around the city." That's because the emergency room was filled with patients who were very sick with COVID, in addition to people coming for heart attacks, appendicitis, and other ailments. As compared to the start of the pandemic, when almost all the patients in emergency rooms were there because of COVID, Dr. Spencer said. There is also a significant number of providers who are unable to work because they tested positive for COVID. In Oklahoma, a 363% increase over the past 2 weeks has overwhelmed hospitals. According to K4TV, three hospital systems reported that they had no intensive care unit beds available. Dr. Dale Blatzler, the hospital's chief COVID officer, said at OU Health in Oklahoma City, the spike in COVID cases poses a challenge for providers treating patients with the virus, but also for non-COVID patients because the hospital must take additional measures to protect them from the virus. He said there are also 250 staff members who are unable to work because they are isolating due to the virus. While Dr. Dale Blatzler hopes that the state could reach its Omicron peak in the next week, he is concerned that the decline could be slower than in other states because only 54% of the population is fully vaccinated, whereas in New York, officials claim the number is 73%. Dr. Dale Blatzler added, I'm much more worried that we will have a substantial increase in hospitalizations over the next few weeks. We're already stretched in our systems, and since unvaccinated people are driving hospitalizations, I'm very worried about that. Still, Aaron Wendelboe, an OU epidemiologist, said that he is a bit encouraged by what is happening in other states. But like other epidemiologists, Aaron Wendelboe said he is not ready to declare that we won't see another surge like Omicron because the virus continues to mutate. He added, I feel like I'm a slower learner because I would not have predicted this big of a surge so quickly, but COVID continues to surprise us. Department of Human and Health Services data shows in 18 states at least 85% of adult intensive care unit beds were in use, while in 24 states at least 80% of the staffed hospital beds were occupied. Alabama, Missouri, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Texas, and Wisconsin are among the states suffering a particular shortage of intensive care unit beds. Moreover, students across the United States have walked out of classes to protest inadequate anti-COVID health measures, demanding a return to remote learning amid the persisting surges of the Omicron variant across the nation. The walkouts come just 2 days after 340,000 students in the major Midwestern city of Chicago, Illinois, returned to the classroom following a 5-day work stoppage due to demands by the Chicago Teachers Union for tougher COVID-19 restrictions. A student group in the city known as Chicago Public Schools Radical Youth Alliance organized a walkout at various city schools on Friday afternoon, 14th of January, followed by a rally outside the district's headquarters. Protesting students in Chicago, home to America's third largest public school district, declared that they were dissatisfied with the additional health protocols that the CTU and City Mayor Lori Lightfoot agreed to. Also, according to local press reports in the major northeastern city of Boston, nearly 600 students from 11 schools walked out of classes on Friday, 14th of January. The Boston Student Advisory Council, which called for the walkout, further posted a series of demands on Twitter, including 2 weeks of remote learning and improved COVID-19 testing for teachers and students. An online petition started by a Boston high school senior says schools are a COVID-19 breeding ground and demanding a remote option, and gathered more than 8,000 signatures as of Friday morning. The latest wave of infections has renewed the debate over whether to keep schools open, as officials seek to balance fears about the highly contagious Omicron variant with concerns that students could fall even further behind after 2 years of stop-and-start instruction. The result has been a patchwork of COVID-19 policies around the country that has left parents feeling exhausted and baffled.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Johnson? That is a question that is being floated in UK politics and amongst Britons. The Prime Minister is facing the biggest challenge to his premiership as the Partygate scandal has snowballed into a political nightmare for him. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the Prime Minister has any magic tricks up his sleeve to save his position and whether his party can actually survive this blow, while the Labour Party's popularity has increased as a result. Paul, to get the latest on this first, I'm going to cross on over to London and talk to our correspondent, Amina Taylor. Amina Taylor, what are we looking at here? I'm looking at front page headlines that does not bode well for the Prime Minister. I'm not too sure which one to ask you about as we're looking at all these different really harsh rhetoric coming from these headlines. You tell us what's standing out right now for Boris Johnson and then for the people there in the UK, how they feel about him.
Well, Kaveh, we're clearly in the containment section of this operation from the Conservative Party, because it was clear that the deny, 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 and then lie stage was proving to be ineffective. Once photos had been released of the latest party that was taking place during the May 2020 lockdown, this is after we had already had news of the one in December, and then to just add misery on top of insult, on top of disbelief, this party that took place on the eve of Prince Philip's funeral. So with all of this in mind, I think what the Tories are trying to do here is to rally the troops, to go with the position that the Sue Gray inquiry, which is of course the civil servant who is in charge essentially of marking the government's homework here on this one, let's wait to see what she has to say and then we make a move. But if Keir Starmer is correct here, it is very difficult to see how the Prime Minister can say he did not break protocol. And if you break protocol and then you're found to have lied about it, it's very difficult to see how you can stay in your position. I think the only thing that is saving Boris Johnson from having to walk the political plank now is the fact that nobody with any real credibility wants the job as the head of the Tory party at the moment. Richie Sunak is the man they're touting. He wouldn't want to touch this dirty basket right now. He'd want to wash his hands until the next election, then swoop in. And Labour, they know this as well, Carvey.
Okay, and before I let you go, just very quickly, if you can, this Operation Save Big Dog, which points to points to government reshuffle, is that accurate? Is it true, or is it just rumors?
It is ludicrous, but I think the idea here is that Boris Johnson is a useful tool for them at the moment. There are still parts where he is liked, but they recognize that it would be electoral suicide for them to get rid of him now, especially with Labour ahead in the polls. So keep him in until we can get a guy and we can distance ourselves from this scandal.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Amina Taylor there, a correspondent from London. Thank you for the latest on this. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. We have John White. He's a writer and political analyst joining us from Edinburgh. Also joining us, Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from Belfast. Very well. Welcome to both of you. John White, let me first start with you. When I asked our correspondent about the latest, she went through the events, which may be, in a sense, overlooked by people who are not so familiar, because we're looking at an explosive set of events that happened one after the other regarding these numerous parties and the way that the government reacted to it, which then, if you take a line to the side of that, is filled with lies, it's filled with silence. Perhaps you can tell us how that does not bode well for the people who are in power, or maybe their days are numbered at this point.
Well, just like the US under Trump, under Johnson, Britain is in a post-truth scenario when it comes to its politics. Boris Johnson is a proven liar, he's a rogue, he's a man for whom integrity is a foreign land, and he seems quite astonishingly impervious to the extent of the anger of the British public over these revelations, which are coming fast and furious by the week of further parties that were taking place in and around Downing Street during lockdown. We're here now, there were regular Friday night wine nights among his staffers and people who work there and work with him closely in his office. So it is quite astonishing the extent, not only to which he seems impervious to the consequences of these actions during strict lockdown, when people up and down the UK were denied the right to be with loved ones on their deathbeds or be with loved ones for months and months on end because of the regulations and the rules that were passed by his government. And he was standing at the rostrum articulating the new regulations as he came in. People couldn't mix, they couldn't see family members, etc. But the Tory party seems to be intent on circling the wagons. Operation Big Dog says it itself. If Al Capone did politics, he would be on the side of Boris Johnson. He doesn't care about public opinion. He thinks he can tough it out. He's a creature of entitlement and privilege. And you get to see how this story is going to run, because what he has done is he's managed to unite the UK media from left to right in anger and splenetic rage at the extent to which his government and people working for his government were flouting lockdown rules throughout 2020 and 2021.
Sure. Well, we're going to get into the way that Boris Johnson has conducted himself when it comes to politics. Some say that's his asset, but in this case, we're not sure about that. But Fra Hughes, I have to ask you this about how you have these parties, one after the other, to bring your booze party, which really then tick people off. I don't want to beat the events to a pulp here, but when it came to that party that was held the night before the funeral of Prince Philip, well, that also struck a nerve with many people there in Britain, especially when you have the picture of the Queen by herself to sit alone due to the coronavirus restrictions. Did that push this whole thing over the edge with that happening? And how badly or severely did that affect public opinion against Johnson?
Well, I think firstly we'll have to maybe acknowledge the fact that there appears to be a campaign to undermine Boris Johnson's premiership. The fact that these leaks are coming thick and fast, one after the other, it appears orchestrated to put pressure and mounting pressure onto Boris Johnson and his cabinet, with ongoing further allegations of these parties. I suppose when it comes to Prince Philip, a lot of the British people are monarchists. I mean, a lot of the tabloid media and a lot of people really from kind of when they're born into the British United Kingdom system or brought up to revere with adulation the royal family. So the fact that they were partying the night before the funeral of Prince Philip does indicate a kind of abject negation of responsibility by those in charge. I mean, normally that would have been, that funeral would have been huge. The military display that would be attendant to the funeral, all the monarchy there in their regalia and their splendor, seeing off Prince Philip. I think it just proves that there is a genuine disconnect between those who run the country, those who see themselves as entitled, and the elite, the people who have been to the various public schools and the public school upbringing that they've had, these multi-millionaires who claim to be in touch with the common people. I think the disregard shown by Boris Johnson and all those who attended maybe proves two things. One thing is, if it wasn't for the leak, we wouldn't know anything about this, and it would be just a continuation of Boris in power.
Who do you think is responsible for the leaks coming out? I mean, we know the first one. I mean, you're saying that there are successive leaks coming out at this pace, that's somewhat not ordinary. But the way the government handled it is obviously also not professionally handled. So that's another aspect of this. But let's move on. And I'm sorry to jump in, because I'd like to move on to how there is now a call from within Johnson's party, John White, sixth Conservative MP, calling for the Prime Minister to quit. We have estimated, based on our sources, 20 may have submitted letters to, I guess, what's called the 1922 committee, well short of the 54 needed, however. And you talked about Operation Save Big Dog. Is that Boris Johnson's way of trying to get out of this?
Well, we're waiting for the conclusions of Sue Gray, the civil servant who's been tasked with investigating the leaks, the parties, etc., which her conclusions are said to will be published at the end of next week. A lot of Tory MPs are following the line of let's wait for the conclusions to her inquiry while they're not supporting Johnson, but just following protocol. But I'm quite surprised there's only 20 letters gone into the 1922 committee thus far, given the extent of the breaches of lockdown. These MPs will be under huge pressure from their constituents. There are local elections coming up in May. This will be a very telling measure of the extent of public opinion regards to Johnson. The latest opinion polls has Labour 14 points ahead. I still think Boris Johnson carries some favour amongst, especially Redwall, the North, new working class base vis-a-vis Brexit. He's seen as more relatable, certainly, than Keir Starmer. Mm-hmm. He likes a drink, he likes a laugh. He's a guy who's prone to scandal. He's got a sense of humour. And that plays well with a lot of people in the country. You know, you feel disconnected from the usual machine politicians such as Keir Starmer. My surprise is that Labour is not further ahead than 14 points, given the extent of these breaches of lockdown, especially, as you just touched upon with Farage Hughes, regarding the party that was held the night before the Queen attended her husband's funeral almost on her own and obeying lockdown rules. So we're yet to see what's going to happen next week. Sue Gray's conclusions, her report will be key in determining the fate of Boris Johnson. He's going to tough it out. Don't forget that Sue Gray is a Johnson appointee, as is Cressida Dick, the head of the Met Police. Sure. And there's a bit of a harsh light shone on her for her inaction so far and willing to investigate previous breaches that have come to light with regards to Johnson and his administration.
Okay. We don't want this, and I'm trying not to make this a Boris Johnson bashing 25-minute block here, but we need to talk about his behavior, Fra Hughes, and I'm going to use the words of a Shoreham MP that I'm sure you're familiar with, Tim Loughton, who has said, the reason for my conclusion and calling for him to stand down is the way that this is handled, and he described it as, quote, obfuscation, prevarication, and evasion to have been the order of the day. Do you agree?
Yes, it's a very good description, and it's very apt, and it's very to the point. First, he denied the allegations. In fact, I think he denied them twice before eventually coming to the fore with the latest information put out into the public domain. He's admitted that he was there. What we're witnessing is Boris Johnson's, it's partly, I think, his personality. He's a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and somebody will just, like, you know, manipulate and the truth in order to sell himself to both the public and the party. I feel that he's been caught out telling fibs. He's been caught out with his finger in the cookie jar, or perhaps the drinks cabinet in this particular instance. But I think he has told or been economical with the truth in the way he's handled this. So there's a bit of buffoonery there. There's a bit of he's admitted that he's made mistakes, but I don't think it's enough to make him go, because I don't think there's enough will within the Conservative Party to throw him under the bus. Mm-hmm. I do think there's an opportunity, if he can see this through, he'll be there until at least May, when they have the local elections. Sure. And see how he finishes after that.
Okay, well, on that, John White, what has Boris Johnson done? I mean, really, if you think about it, he's the one that perhaps gained his notoriety, in a sense, from Brexit, the deadlock that gripped the UK for so many years, if not the whole world, in a sense. So, what, aside from that, can you tell us?
Well, nothing really. He's gained a lot of credit from Brexit. He's completely mishandled COVID in the UK. 150,000 COVID dead tells its own story. He was too slow to lock down, and when he did lock down, over 2 months after China locked down in January of 2020, he didn't lock down hard enough. He has known to have said, let the bodies pile high, when he was faced with the prospect of having to implement another lockdown. And so, you know, it's surprising to me that he hasn't been forced out of office up to now. The PPE scandals, the High Court in London just recently adjudged that his VIP lane, so-called, giving PPE contracts to Tory donors and so on, on the pretext of COVID, was illegal. So this is a administration, a government that's mired in scandal, illegality, lies, obfuscation, as you mentioned, and just being economical with the truth. There seems to be no lie that he won't tell, his ministers won't tell, in order to bolster their position. So the corruption is deep and it's unending. So, you know, he is a rogue prime minister, probably in a long line of such. And it's remarkable to me, as I say, that he's not being forced out of office. You know, I just think this reflects a debased political culture in the UK surrounding Brexit.
Sure. Well, on the line of what you said earlier, Frau Hughes, I'm going to go with two viewer comments here. One, so our politicians lied to us. What a surprise. The real news here is that government officials never have taken the COVID threat seriously. The big question is, why should we? And the next viewer comment, I think, it's shocking that Johnson may force subordinates to resign and not himself. The boss carries the responsibility. Boris Johnson is not the ideal PM. But if he resigns, I see no credible candidates to replace him. Should we look at Boris Johnson, the man, and separate him from the party? Or are they both in this thing together?
Well, first of all, he's leading the party. And secondly, I mean, there was an invitation to perhaps, was it 100 people, to bring your own and have the party in the Downing Street gardens. And only 30 people turned up. That's telling in itself. That, you know, would imply that 70 people who were invited said to themselves, no, I don't think this maybe is a very good idea. Don't think it's maybe very appropriate under the circumstances with what else is happening with COVID regulations in the country. As I've said, Johnson's leading the party, so he has ultimate responsibility for whatever he does as an individual and also as the leader of the party. But he's got a huge majority. There aren't any elections, meaningful elections outside of the council elections until 2024. He's not going to resign. I mean, there's no way someone with that personality who's been able to get himself to the top of British politics is just going to fall on the sword, and he won't go unless he's pushed. And I can't see there being a groundswell of people within the Conservative Party looking rid of Boris Johnson at the moment. And I completely agree with John. I mean, we are just seeing the tip of the corruption iceberg that is British politics. And it's not just British politics. It's all the neoliberal governments across Europe and in America. They're up to their necks in graft, and they're paid for by corporations, and they treat the rest of us, especially the voters, with disdain. The only care about us once every 4 years when we go into the polling booth and put our X against someone's name. And normally it isn't a name, normally it's a party. And with the two-party system we have, both moving further and further to the right, working class people in Britain will suffer for decades to come, regardless of whether or not Boris Johnson's in power this time next year?
Well, you know, when you take a look at what's happening in the world right now, John White, I mean, we're looking at Europe, in particular NATO and the U.S., and the way that they're confronting Russia. We're looking at our part of the world, where we get sanctioned every other day, practically, and other world events that shape the world in one shape or another in a major way. That we're looking at the U.K. and parties where you have to bring your own alcohol. So when you have being the U.K. trait right now and how it's made headlines, perhaps what I'm looking at here was a quote that was made by a particular MP that says, what we're seeing right now is the culture at 10 Downing Street that is necessary for it to change. What is this culture of 10 Downing Street that requires a change in it, if you agree with that?
Well, it's like the dying days of Rome. We're seeing these parties in Downing Street with people, procuring suitcases full of wine, cavorting in the Downing Street gardens, flouting lockdown rules and regulations at the same time as the morgue were filled up with COVID dead, NHF nurses and clinicians were at breaking point, suffering PTSD, dealing with the consequences of COVID, that it's at the height of the pandemic in the UK. It's really redolent of the dying days of Rome. And Fra touched on something very important when he mentioned the word neoliberalism. This is a product of late capitalism. This is a demise of the West on a broader level. And these politicians like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are a product of those dying days. They are the corruption that a corrupt political system produced. And I see this as a very serious inflection point in global politics. The UK coming out of Brexit, that was a last gasp, a death rattle of British imperialism, thinking that resorting to nationalism, Union Jack flag waving, can deal with the problems wrought by neoliberalism in a time of crisis. The wrong lessons have been learned from the financial and economic crash of 2008, mm-hmm. and neoliberalism is a corpse, and it's a putrefying corpse that needs to be buried. Boris Johnson is not the man to bury that corpse. Neither is Keir Starmer. So we're looking at the demise of the UK as a state, and I look forward to the day that it breaks up, because it's on the way of breaking up. It has no answers to the challenges of the 21st century, and Boris Johnson is a product of the same apparatus as Keir Starmer is. Nothing good can come of either of those two men in power for the UK to remain a unified state.
Sure. Well, I was going to talk about Keir Starmer, but I don't know after what John White said there, I should get into that. But I have to, because in regards to the ratings, where you have, obviously, Boris Johnson's ratings to have plummeted, and we're looking at Labour actually to pretty much on the back of this gained 41% of the vote share based on one particular poll. I don't know if you're a fan of polls there, Fra Hughes. This one by Opinium, putting Labour on 41% of the vote share. Conservatives at 31%. Is there a chance for Labour to come on? I mean, we're looking, obviously, at Keir Starmer at this point heading that party. But is he, as he says, perhaps somebody that could act in the public interest should he resign, in reference to Johnson?
I think in truth and in honesty, what we'll have is we have a two-party system, the same as they do in America and most of Western Europe. So what happens is when the incumbent government or the prime minister becomes a failure or is shown through his actions to be incompetent or uncaring, what we have is the pendulum that swings once upon a time from the conservative right wing to the Labour left wing. And then with Tony Blair, obviously he brought New Labour to central politics. And I would say that Starmer is a devotee of Tony Blair's politics. It's mm-hmm. funny that Margaret Thatcher's kind of best outcome was the election of Tony Blair. So I think what we have now, if you're looking at Starmer as someone who is a real challenge to Boris Johnson, I don't think he is. I think he's a complete lightweight. I think with the destruction and the destroying of the reputation of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a lot of people who are traditional Labour voters who will not vote sure. Labour under Keir Starmer. And I think what we have is we have a Tory-liked prospective uh-huh. Prime Minister in
okay.
waiting.
Let me jump in here quickly, because we're fresh out of time, and ask John White the last question. John White, you said how even the two parties here are not suffice to deal with what the UK has to deal with. And one of the issues that are at the top of the agenda for any country now is how to deal with COVID, how to make sure economic progress is going to be made, amongst all the other issues that are involved when it comes to the UK. So what are we looking at in terms of the UK's future here? How it's going to grow out of COVID when you have these scandals bringing down the current government, as it appears?
Well, COVID, in the one sense, has been a political distraction from the problems surrounding Brexit, because all the new regulations that are going to come into force regarding Brexit come into force by the summer. So we're going to see real chaos at the ports. There's still the issue of Ireland and the border down the Irish Sea, and we've seen a push towards Irish unity, such as we haven't seen since partition in the early 1920s. We're seeing a huge upswing in support for Scottish independence. And all the while in England, they seem to be turning more and more insular in terms of their politics, in terms of the culture wars that have been unleashed there by Brexit. It's unleashed, to my mind, the forces of racism. Britain is no longer a major power, but it's trying to masquerade as one, and it's always been able to do so under the umbrella of US hegemony. Uh-huh. But since coming out of the EU, the UK is now seen as an important ally to the US as it was hitherto. And so we're yet to see how this will play out in global terms. Johnson is an embarrassment. There are multiple crises that face Britain right now, including foreign policy, including economics, including Indeed. The fallout from COVID, including trade, etc., etc. So this is a distraction. And I think at some point, Tory MPs, backbenchers, will have to look at their own position with regards to their constituents.
Okay.
The election comes in 2024. On this trajectory, the Tories will lose their 80-seat majority. We'll see Keir Starmer as the new Prime Minister.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. John White there. Thank you for your contribution. Writer and political analyst from Edinburgh, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator from Belfast. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitaev, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.